Pete Coughlan was a physical, hands-on guy throughout his young life. He'd served in the British Army for a while, and he was trained in the martial arts. In Australia, Pete started a new life as a carpenter. But one day, when he was just 30 years old, Pete suffered a terrible stroke. When he came to, Pete could see and hear the visitors and the hospital staff in the room, but he couldn't move, and he couldn't speak, and he was also hallucinating wildly. Pete was trapped inside himself. This is what's known as locked-in syndrome. For a lot of people, this would be one of those worst-case scenarios, and there were moments of terrible despair and even horror. But with incredibly fierce determination and plenty of loving care, Pete gradually found a way back out of himself and into the world. And 6 months later, Pete came out of hospital, a completely changed man. Hello, Pete.
How are you, Richard?
All right. What's your mobility like at the moment, Pete?
I would like it a bit better because that's me. But I think I'm about 95% now. I'm just issues with my reach a bit and a slight limp, but I've more or less done it.
I noticed you walked up the stairs. Is it hard for you to walk upstairs?
It's a challenge, but I like a challenge.
Is it one side of the body more than the other at the moment with you?
Yes, one side of my body has come back 100%. But the right side, I've had to really struggle getting it back, and that's taken so much dedication. And I'm almost there, but I don't know how long, I can't put time on it, but I'd like to think this year I'll hammer it.
Do you favour your left side now, or are you really actively trying to make your right side do things in order to, I don't know, get that back up to speed again?
You have to keep things real. When it comes to hot plates and dishes and things where you could hurt yourself, then I will use my left arm. But wherever possible, cups of tea, biscuits, anything like that, itching the face, or that, I always try using my right arm, right hand. I think it'll balance out eventually. If I keep doing that, it will.
You said on the way in that you're a kind of a baby. What do you mean by that? Can you explain?
It sounds silly to everyone else, but I see myself as a five-year-old. When you're born with movement. And when I had my stroke and was locked in, I couldn't move a single muscle. I couldn't cry like a baby. So I see myself as a five-year-old, but I've done everything in 5 years. I've learned to talk, I've learned to eat, I've learned to stand and walk and work and drive and everything all in that 5 years. So yeah, I see myself a five-year-old. I've not just done an hour a day. What annoys me really is a lot of people expect to get better by just going through the motions. And unfortunately, I think you have to put in much more than an hour a day. I used to do 6 hours a day. And if I was too tired for physio, it'd be writing. I'd do lines like school kids, A, B, C, D. It took me a month to hold a pen, just to put a pen in my thumb. It would fall out, I'd put it back in again. It'd fall out, I'd put it back in. And I was determined to hold that pen. And it did after a month or two, it started gripping. And I had to start using a fine liner first, because a big pen was too hard. And then it gradually worked up to a ballpoint pen.
We're talking in Perth at the moment, and this is where you live now. But is that a Mancunian accent I can detect there, Pete?
It never leaves you, even when you learn to talk again.
City or United, or is no opinion on that?
Well, I have to say City because my dad would kill me.
So what did your dad say when you joined the army?
Well, I'd always wanted to go in the army, but he wanted me to go in the trades like himself. He was a joiner. I wanted to be a soldier. And in the end, he let me, and I think he's proud of me.
You were posted to Northern Ireland. What do you remember at that time?
I remember when they called out the paperwork and I passed the selection, and they called out my name, Coughlan, Northern Ireland, and everyone was getting their placements, and I didn't know the first thing about Northern Ireland. I didn't know what to expect, and it's a lovely place, but unfortunately there's a lot of trouble there, and I didn't know what didn't want to expect at all. And I got to my regiment, and we were told we were going to assist the IUC police in riot peace control, crowd control. We'd take over police at intervals with shields and stand there, and it was just like you were just put there to hold back 200 strong angry crowd that just didn't like you. They didn't know you, but they didn't like you because your presence was there. So you just had to stand there with a shield, and while they threw petrol bombs or stones or bottles of fire, everything, and just stand there and cringe. As a 18, 19-year-old lad, that was quite affronting. I mean, on the way to the riots, I was driving a platoon commander, and we came across on a bypass. There was a load of cars set fire on the middle of the bypass to stop us coming through. We weren't allowed to stop the vehicles because in danger of ambush. I was going to slow down because, you know, you don't normally drive every day through cars on fire. And then my platoon commander said, don't stop. Pull the windscreen visor up and just drive foot down full. And I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, here we go. So we just sped up to like 90, 100 mile an hour and smashed right through these cars. They're on fire. And it's something your body does not let you do. You don't want to do that sort of thing.
What do you see when you're in a vehicle that's crashing into a flaming car?
I expected myself to go through the windscreen, but luckily, obviously, I stayed in place. It's something you just don't do. To go against something your brain tells you not to do is so hard.
And how did you feel about being in the army after seeing and doing all that?
It was an experience. It's a shame that we were hated so much for being soldiers there, because I didn't know the first thing about all the details going on there. I was just went to be a young soldier and do my best and help the world. And I didn't think I'd be causing anger for being somewhere. So, yeah, that side of it bugged me a little bit, but it was a good experience and it trained me well for life, I think.
You almost died while you were in the army, Pete. Tell me what happened.
I never know what caused my sickness, but in the army I used to carry these sifters around with me. They make a buzzing noise when you come across explosive activity and things. So I'm not quite sure. There's some evidence saying they are causing cancer. I'm not sure, but that is something no one can argue about because we don't know.
How did you start to notice something was wrong?
Well, I'd gone into the MO. My running times were terrible. And I was really struggling in the chest to breathe. And he said, yeah, I think you've got asthma. So I was taking these inhalers all the way around. And my times were not improving. My sergeant was shouting at me, saying, come on, Cogs, get up there. Stop being lazy, get up there. And swearing at me and stuff. And one time he even threw my helmet at me and said, get up there, you lazy bugger. So I went back in and said, look, these are not helping me. Please help me with someone else. I said, well, it takes a while for them to kick in and get used to them. Anyway, my girlfriend at the time, Julianne, from Northern Ireland, noticed this big lump in my neck. It's like a golf ball. It just came up like I was having a pint and a carbonara. I always remember that. A pint of Stella and a carbonara. And then my dad said to me, what's that lump on your neck? And then Julianne and my dad said, you've got to get it checked out. That's just appeared. Yeah, so I went in the next day and they sent me for an X-ray. So I was doing dry mortar drills on the field and this Land Rover turned up behind me and the guy said to me, Cogs, get in, your locker's packed, all your stuff packed, you've got to go straight to hospital. So I didn't get time to pack my stuff and I was thinking, what's going on? And that night they gave me a biopsy and by the morning, my 21st birthday, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma.
How did they treat it?
Well, they had come up with a new milkshake, I call it, of chemotherapy, and they started me on the treatment straight away, and it did seem very effective. It was at stage 2B, nearly 3, when they caught me, and with 6 months of chemo and three or four weeks of radiotherapy, it actually subsided the... The lumps were everywhere. They were under my armpits. They were in my groin. I felt really, really frail and, scary times.
How completely did you recover from Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Well, I lost my hair. I lost everything at my joints and my mobility was affected at first. Climbing stairs was difficult. My wrists were very, very stiff and achy. And I was treated at my father's place in Anglesey, and I hid from the world for a while, went fishing every day and things like that. And over a year, I slowly got stronger, began to gain weight again, and to the point where, after a year, I thought, you know what, I'm ready for work, and I began laying bricks again.
So that was it for your army career after that then?
Yes, that was it, yeah, and I went back. I never even got time to say goodbye to anybody. But my sergeant, he used to throw his helmet at me and say, get up there, Cogs. He actually got cancer at the same time as me. He was in the same ward as me, and we talked, and the person that I used to think, I didn't like him at first. And then over that situation, we got very close, talking to each other, bedsides and stuff. He actually died, unfortunately, and I made it. And I'll stay with him the rest of my life because, yeah, to be shouted by your sergeant to get up there, and then next thing you know, you're at the funeral where all your friends are, and everyone's whispering, saying, there's Cox. And they hadn't seen me for a good year, but I was, you know, healthy and still alive, and I was at my sergeant's funeral, you know, laying him to rest, and that was a real awkward moment because it could have been me, you know, it could have been me.
Tell me how you met Jade.
Jade was a massive part of my recovery and a massive part of my life. I first met Jade when I was serving in Northern Ireland and I'd come back on home leave with her brother, Damien. And the first moment I saw her, I fell in love with her. And little did I know what the future had in store for us, but yeah, it was magic times back then.
What brought you and Jade to Australia?
Well, I'd had a work visa here for a year, laying bricks. And I thought to myself, when I got back in the rain and the cold as England is, I dreamt of Perth's blue skies, and I just longed to come back.
How were things working out for you when you moved here with Jade?
It was amazing, really, because we'd had an outdoor life, barbecues and drinking a lot, which I didn't really do before, but I drank a lot. But I was having a great time. I was having a great time. We had spas. People had outdoor spas. People were entertaining outside. It never seems to rain here. I loved it. I love Perth.
The 21st of March, 2011. Tell me how that day unfolded for you at work, Pete.
Well, I'd gone to work to help a friend out. My father-in-law, actually, I said I'd give him a hand at weekend, putting some storm water pipes in. And it was a very hot day. And I was in the trenches, cleaning them up to make sure they're all going down at the right grade for the pipes to sit in. And the diggers lower them, the pipes down with chains, and you guide them into position and check them at layer level. Well, I was doing that, and I was really into this job. I liked the job, and I enjoyed helping him. And then one day it was really hot, and I'd done quite a lot of pipes, and I thought, you know, my back's getting a bit sore. And I stood up too quick to stretch my back. And I didn't realise these particular pipes were going under the road, a junction. So behind my head, I forgot the edge of the road was still there. And when you see curbs, everyone sees curbs over here as smooth because the granite workers made them all perfect. But underneath in the sand, they are sometimes like razor blades. They're really, really like sharp and spiky and stuff. And this one bit of concrete was sharp and it just happened to be right behind my head. And I lifted my head up and bang, it was like someone put a pickaxe at the back of my head. And I remember rubbing it and I actually swore, I said, fucking hell. It hurt so much and I couldn't do anything about 5 minutes. But then I carried on and thought, oh, that's going to give me a headache, that is. That's going to really give me a headache. And then I thought nothing else of it at all. And my vision went slightly when I was in the trench. And I couldn't sort of see for a second. It's like when you rub your eyes too hard, the stars come up. That's what it's like. It was like I just suddenly got stars in my eyes. And then it became back clear again. I thought, that's weird. That's a bit odd. But as a worker does, carry on. And then on the way home, we stopped on Joondalup Drive to get a mocha, which I love mochas. And I stopped at the shop to get a mocha. Picked up in the fridge as normal. Hey mate, how you doing? Gave him the money. And then he gave me the change to this mocha. And just as he gave me the change, my vision totally went. My hearing was still there, but it totally went. I couldn't see a thing. And he was saying, there you go, mate, there you go. And obviously it was, I saw the beginning of his hand moving towards to give me the change, but I lost the vision of his hand. I didn't know where his hand was to get the change. So I just held my hand out and I felt the money go into it. And for a second, I stood there in the shop. I thought, oh my God, and I prayed to God because I was scared to death. And then he just came back and I unbelievably just started running back towards the Toyota and said to Ted, I said, look, this has just happened to me in the shop. And I can't believe it. I must go and get my eyes checked. That's the first thing I thought. I thought, my vision is going, so go to doctors and get my eyes checked. I thought, yeah, I'll go tomorrow. And I should have gone there, and then I just didn't know. And I got in the car and we drove home. We had a cold cider at the bar. And I quite often had heat stroke. And I thought I had heat stroke. So I said to Jade, I'm going to go and lie down and have a sleep. So I went to bed. But 4 hours later, I woke up. And my face was all pins and needly on one side. And my leg was very hard to get out of the bed. It was weak. But I could do it. But it was all weak. It was like you had sat in your arm too long and it had gone numb. So then I proceeded to walk to the bar where my friends were luckily all there. They said to me, what's up? You're like seeing a ghost. And I said, I don't feel very well. I think I've had a stroke. And they all just looked at me. And it wasn't what I said that freaked me out. It was what their faces were like. They all stared at me with this horror. And what I actually said to them, and when I said, I think of a stroke, I said, blah, 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 like total garbage. And that's what they were amazed about. And they looked at me. And that was the last I remember, because I was told, then Jade said she walked around the garden. Apparently all I asked for was a cup of tea and toast. I'd be all right. Cup of tea and toast, I'd be okay.
How did you get to hospital?
My sister works in a hospital and she, luckily enough, Googled the symptoms and they did realise that something was seriously wrong and they decided, thank God, quick thinking, to get me to Joondalup Hospital as quick as possible. So they carried me almost. I mean, I was still walking slightly, but I wasn't with it.
And are you conscious of this? Do you remember all this, or is this what you've been told afterwards?
No, I can't. This is what I'm told. This is the part of the story that I have to rely on others. But I do remember once they'd put me into the four-wheel drive, I seem to have gained a bit of consciousness on the way up to Joondalup. And I remember not being able to control my head and my head falling like a cannonball. And my body was totally limp by this point. I couldn't have no control over any movement at all. And I was being sick in the car. And Jade had hold of my chest around from the back of the seat to hold me in position because I kept falling on the driver, Dave. And Dave was driving as fast as he could. Even though he wanted to get done by the police, but he just put his foot down. And luckily for him, he got there in time. And by the time I got to hospital, I don't remember a thing. But on the way to Joondalup Hospital, I remember just thinking, why can't I move my head? What's going on? Please, God, help me. And I could just see the traffic lights, the freeway lights spinning past me. And it's very, very upsetting. It's hard for me to think of now.
You slipped into a coma? How long for? Do you have any idea how long you were in a coma for?
I was told, Jade, it was about 3 to 4 days.
Were you waking, coming conscious, coming to at any time during that period?
I don't remember. I think one thing, but the doctors told Jade that every time I came round, I was shaking hysterically. And my arms were twisting in ways they shouldn't, and they were spasming, and it was too dangerous to keep me awake because I was going to do myself harm. So they put me back in the coma.
Right, you were in a medically induced coma then after that.
Mm.
What sort of visions were appearing to you at this time? The reason I ask is, I've talked to people about this in the past, and they've gone through these extraordinary experiences where they've had alternate lives in these coma periods. Did you have something like that?
Yeah, I was raped in my... I don't want to be too graphic on the radio, but I was raped. I didn't realise, but it was an enema. And when you're given an enema, I was aware of the body feeling that. And I visualised I was actually in Thailand in a purple room and people were taking turns on me. It was very disturbing.
How real was that?
I remember my friend Danny had come for a visit, and although I couldn't see him, I had visions of him there, and I thought, I was begging him for him to take me away, begging him to carry me out, and yeah, I really believed I was a prostitute in a big purple room.
Did you have a feeling like you had a history of that too, like this was another whole life, or was it just you, Pete, suddenly in this different place?
I think what it was, I was in Thailand a week before renewing our visas, and I associated myself as still being there. I don't know why, but I believed I was in this one house across the road from a shop we used to go to regular, and we were locked in there, and it seemed to change from one, like flicking a page, different movies and different pages, because that was my vision for a while. And then this could have been over days, I've no idea. But then the page would change, and then Jade was then, how do I say on the radio, where she was being raped or involved in a gangbang. And this, oh, I could see this big blue ottoman, and yeah, and lots of men around her. And I had to sit there and watch that. It was like smoke in the room. And I had to sit and endure all that. That destroyed me.
And while you were having these visions, was there part of you going, oh, I've had a stroke and I know I'm hallucinating? Or were you really there in your mind?
I was really there. I really was there. I had to listen to all the noises and, oh, it was terrifying. And I just wanted to get out of bed and kill everyone, but I couldn't move.
That was hell.
It was.
How did that then shift? How did that shift out of there and into some notion that you were actually in hospital, back in real life again?
The next page that turned was this. I was locked in a big white room in a chair with a needle stuck on my arm, and I wanted someone to come and help me, but nobody would come. All I could see was this round window with nurses walking past, but nobody would come in. I heard the beeping noise, which obviously must have been on the ward by this time, but I wasn't aware I was in the ward, but I could hear the beeping noise, so obviously it was. There was like a huge room, maybe 10 metres by 10 metres, with nothing but tiles, and me sat in a wheelchair with a big needle stuck in my arm, and it was cold. I remember it being very cold. And then I flicked the page again to these two little men that were running around my chest, these two men in blue suits, and they were running around my chest, and they were pulling my my covers up and wiping my brow, and it was so real, so real. They were like 3 inches, but there were two little men looking after me.
And in these kind of alternate realities, were you unable to move and speak? Or were you moving about and doing things?
No, I still couldn't move. I said I was trapped, but I was being looked after.
So all these layers of hallucination.
Strangely enough, everyone had heads and sticks as well, like a Muppet show. It wasn't real. It was so surreal.
And was there a moment when the page turned again and you were lying in a hospital room, in Joondalup Hospital?
No, I think the first response I had was my hearing. I could hear. I couldn't see. I could just hear. It was darkness and I could hear. My mum was talking to a doctor. I could hear words being said like, oh, well, he may be needing a peg feed. It may take time. It's too early to tell yet. We're going to monitor the situation. I didn't know what a peg feed was. You know, when you get fed to the stomach. I do now. But they're talking about these things. And I was thinking, I'm here. Hello, I'm here.
Did then your sight come back to normal then? Could you start to see real doctors, real nurses, real family members around your bed?
Well, about 24 hours, maybe 2 days later, my eyes began to work, and the first thing I could see is a clock like you've got there behind you. And it's very common for strokes, but double vision, I had two clocks, exactly the same, and I wasn't sure which was real, the left-hand one or the right-hand one. Two switches, two TVs, two everything. I couldn't look at anything. My eyes, weirdly enough, would only move up and down. They wouldn't move sideways, so I couldn't look sideways, but I had a small bit of movement ahead that could move me to one side where I could just about see a care plan on the wall, which is a picture of a wheelchair with my needs on it, and a picture of me in the wheelchair. I just wanted to scream, but I couldn't scream, I couldn't cry, I couldn't do a thing.
You wanted to do that?
First reaction was to cry, like a baby, but I couldn't. There was just no movement.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Fadler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to our podcast. It's easy and it's free. Go to abc.net.au/conversations.
I'm with Pete Coghlan. At the age of 30, Pete suffered a massive brainstem stroke, which left him with locked-in syndrome, where he could see and hear people around him, but couldn't move, not a bit. You could move your eyeballs up and down, but not side to side.
No.
And move your head a tiny bit. And was that it? Was that the sum total of your movement?
That was the sum total. And so they fitted me with a buzzer on a pillow, so I could buzz, but I thought my ear just made contact with it, which meant for a nurse to know that I needed help.
When you're in this state, though, Pete, what kind of conversations could you hear people having about you?
You pick up on everything. You hear everything. You hear about nurses talking about extensions. They might be passing conversation in the corridor. Sleeping was really hard because you'd hear the ward phone going all night and the code blues when people were going to die or cardiac arrest. And you'd hear code blue, code blue, code blue, and then rush of footsteps down the corridor. And I would lie in there thinking, oh my God, I'm next. I might die myself next.
Were you hearing people talk about your condition?
I did hear people outside the door, and I don't know who it was. I'm not allowed to tell you things. I just heard, because I had super hearing after a while. I was listening so hard, I was so scared. I heard a nurse say, shh, don't tell him. And I didn't know what that meant. I don't know what's happening to me. I think because I didn't know, I tried. Maybe if you know, you don't try. If the brain is told it can't do something, it won't do it. If it believes it can, then people try. And when they try, sometimes the most unbelievable results happen.
I'm trying to imagine what it would be like, Pete, to be lying there. And what, you couldn't swallow, could you?
I couldn't. I didn't have the stomach muscles. From the very beginning when I first woke up, I got used to a young nurse's knock on the door and saying, hi, I'm such and such, I'm your nurse for the day. And they were really nice and good. But say like you had no control of your bowels, so because you just come out of ICU, you're still full of these drugs and they've messed you up something rotten and you haven't got any stomach muscles to control your movements or any prostate to stop you peeing. So you just poo and piss yourself as and when it came because you've got no stomach muscles. You can't do as we all do, push and strain on the toilet. So you have to rely on suppositories. And then you get these young, pretty nurses, like 18 or, something gorgeous. And then they're rolling you over and they've got to shove pills at your bottom and then say, okay, ring the bell when you need to, when you think you're ready or you feel it's moving. So then ring the bell. And it was so embarrassing. It was just so embarrassing, so degrading. They say you leave your dignity at the door in these places, and it's true. Wow, I've never been so degraded in my life. It's not what you'd expect at 33.
In those early stages where you had absolutely no way of communicating, is there any way you can even describe what that's like, Pete? That properly locked-in moment where you have no means of communication with anyone, but you can still hear and see what people are saying and doing.
I cried and cried and cried. I still feel like crying now. It's been 5 years, but it still hits me, emotionally hits me. I was tried with some glasses. The idea was supposed to blink and then it would work on the computer and stuff. That terrified me. That really terrified me.
Why did that terrify you?
Well, I think it's the idea that it might be permanent. I didn't want to be. I didn't, you know, you visualize your life, and I thought, well, I want to talk, like any function you want to do. If you can do it before, you want to do it now, and I couldn't. I couldn't accept that that was me. I had to talk, like I'm doing now, and I do wonder if that's some people rely on communication through technology quite a lot, and I know that some haven't got a choice. But if I had accepted that from the very first moment, would I have been still using it? Interesting.
Are you religious?
I am now.
You weren't before?
I'm not. I go to church every week sort of person, but yes, I do say my prayers all the time now. And it's something that I'd never really thought of before, but when I had no speech and I had no one to talk to, then I had only one person to speak to, and that's my nana and my granddad and God. And I remember saying prayers to him a lot, and I asked him if he can give me one hand back so I could feed myself, or one hand back so I could itch. Then I promised to spend the rest of my life helping other people. And actually, one hand did come back, not like a miracle there and then, but over the progression of a few months, it did. One hand has come back 100%. So I never knew what to think. How can you explain that? So I'm not going to be preaching or saying to people, oh, you got to do this, you got that. It was just the way it's happened. I've said a few prayers on the way, and they've all freakily come true.
Swallowing. How hard is it to learn how to swallow all over again?
Well, it was the one thing that saved my life, actually. But yeah, trying to initially get the swallow to go, just, it seemed impossible. It seemed just an impossible task. They used to put me in with the speech therapist, Robin, and she would try cold jellies in my mouth and try and trigger the swallow off. They'd put quite often the jelly would go in, and we'd have the sessions, and then I'd spit the jelly out again because the swallow wasn't happening. There was nothing there. We did this for a few weeks, and then eventually we got one swallow, and it was like I'd won the lottery. The swallow was the biggest single turning point in my life.
Isn't there a danger you can actually ingest stuff into the lungs? When you're in that state,
you can get pneumonia very easily. I had pneumonia four times. I even at a later stage, because when you swallow, your tongue learns to control the fluid, so you swallow it and it goes down the right place. But then, if you can't control the liquids or they're too thin and they move, because if you imagine your tongue is controlling the fluid, but if your tongue isn't working properly, then the fluid can't be controlled properly. So it sneaks down the lungs, and then that's what can start pneumonia, yeah.
After some days, you were presented with an alphabet board. Can you explain how that works?
I was very, very lucky. My brother-in-law, Brad, his sister was injured in a road accident as a child, so they presented her with a board not so similar to mine, but that's where the idea came from, with pictures on it and names of family and friends and certain words. Now, I didn't have that one. I chose the option of just the alphabet only, like A to Z, on a card. And the way it'd work is you get 4 to 5 letters per line. Each one's coloured differently, and it's double-sided, so the nurse and the patient can see it. And the board is held out from the patient, and you would call out the colours first. When the letter is on that colour, you blink once, and then they're like, okay, it's on green, so it's 1 of 4. So then they call that E, F, G.
Oh, man, that's really laborious, isn't it?
Then you blink again.
Right, so you've got to blink your way through every letter. What was the first question you asked?
The very first word I said, because my head was still not ticking right, so to speak, was shorts, because I didn't want to be naked in hospital anymore with all these pretty nurses and stuff. Shorts were my first word, yeah. But then me and Jade had lengthy discussions over time, over many days, about why she'd done what she did in Thailand, and And none of it happened. It was all fictitious.
This was still with you, all those awful hallucinations?
I was. It's like any man that's had a woman that's had an affair on a man. The pain inside was there, and I had to discuss it with her. That was the first thing on my mind. And she was like, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about?" And I said, "Why did you do it to me? Why? And it took me a few weeks to come to terms with that and then realise that I'm here in Perth, not in Thailand. There was a lot of obstacles I had to sort out of my head first before I could concentrate on just accepting the situation. That was most important to me, to find out why what had happened. Like, I was still dealing with rape. People go through months of counselling for that. So I had like a week to deal with rape, to deal with my wife cheating on me, which didn't happen.
None of it happened. But it was real in your mind.
But I had to deal with it still.
And was it? Did it take long for you to be persuaded that had all been a hallucination?
Yeah, Jade was wonderful. She explained it all, and she was very hurt that I even thought she'd do that. But yeah, it was a strange world I was in.
If you're blinking your way through the alphabet, how hard was it when you needed to communicate something really urgently?
I learned very early on, if you shorten words and you make it as simple as you can for the nurses, they would help you more inclined to use the board. And then as time progressed, I would spell out things like, you know, you look nice today, or I like your perfume, or, you know, little nice comments, because that's something I missed the most about having no speech. Just to pass a compliment is a wonderful privilege. It's a privilege. It's not a task. It's a privilege.
What happened when you saw a big, fat, hairy millipede on your arm?
I was terrified. I have no words for it, really, except for it was raining. I was all snuggled in bed, and I thought, yeah, try again tomorrow sort of thing. I was thinking about physio. I was thinking about working with Alicia and getting my standing better and my sit-to-stands. And the rain outside was driving the insects inside, and a millipede just appeared on my arm, and I could see it with my eyes, because my eyes were looking, they could work normal, my eyes at the time. I spent about 2-3 weeks trying to move my eyes around the coving on the ceiling to retrain them. With doing it every day, I managed to get a little bit further, and I pushed the eye retina to push a bit further every day, and I built it back up again. So I got my eyes back, and I could see this millipede, and the millipede was crawling up toward the neck, and I could feel it. All I could do was frantically ring the buzzer for a nurse to come in, and the nurse wasn't arriving, so I could feel it crawling up. I thought, what if it goes in my ears? What if it goes in my nose or my mouth? And I was terrified. It's your worst nightmare. I mean, bugs are bugs. We all hate bugs now, and we can put them outside, we can stand on them. But what if you can't move? How terrifying is that?
How did you alert the staff to the fact that there was a millipede?
It was night shift, and this lady, Eleanor, came in, and she managed to come quite quickly and pick up my board and try and attempt to find out what the problem was. And I was trying to spell millipede. Now, I know it's an easy word to spell when you've got a pen in your hand and you think for a second, but when you're terrified and the millipede's about to go into your ears, I was trying to spell out millipede at a ridiculous rate, and this lady wasn't used to the board as well, so I was given a pretty tall order, really, to find out what it was. So I gave up on the word millipede, and I just spelled out the word spider. And she looked and went, where? And just then she seen it, like under my earlobe, and she flicked off into a bin, screamed.
How relieved were you when that got flicked off?
If I could have given a kiss, I would. Wow. You saved my night.
Did you really reach a point of despair?
Well, when I first woke up at Charlie's, yes, Cora, my nurse, I called in one day, and I just had no hope at all. I wanted to die. I was sick of getting mopped up every day, at least twice a day, from feces all over my bed, getting bed washed, and I just felt like a rag doll. I couldn't handle it any longer. I just cried and cried. I had nasal gastric tube, so I wasn't even enjoying food. couldn't I enjoy drinking liquid or talk to anyone or even itch. I had enough. I wanted to die. And I asked the spell on board to Cora. I said, I want to die, please. And she said to me, you're doing so well. Why do you want to die? And I thought, why am I doing so well? How can I be doing so well? What quality have I got? I can't do a thing or blink, and I'm doing so well. I didn't understand that. But then later on I realised that I was doing okay because my vital statistics they were talking about were all evening out to a better level, and I should have been dead, so being alive is better than dead. Yeah, in their eyes I was doing well, but to me I was to die.
You said you were lying in bed there getting your stereoscopic vision back again by training it on the curve of the ceiling. How long would you do that for when you would try and push yourself, Pete?
Well, in that four-week stage at Charlie's, there was many very basic tasks that I had to get grip to save my life. One was swallowing spit. You've no idea how much saliva. I was just dribbling mess. Once I got my first swallow with Robin, I knew I had to swallow. So it felt like I was swallowing all day long. Like, oh, you know, you're not conscious of it now, and nobody ever is. But because my swallow was like a really gulp, and I really had to think about it and try hard.
So you could spend a whole day?
A whole day
concentrating on swallowing.
Trying to swallow my spit so I didn't choke because it was building up my mouth and it was going to choke me. But I just had to keep swallowing it, otherwise I'd go die.
But what's the feeling of mastery of that like once you do it, though? Once you are swallowing? Is that a triumph or not?
Well, it is, but you never, as anyone out there that's had a stroke will tell you, they will not see their change in their recovery. They will think they are not improving because you don't see it. You might see it if you video yourself and a year later you look at it, but you don't see it. So, I could never see the change. So once I mastered, but to me it was just, I could survive. It was just enough to keep me alive. Once I'd finished doing the swallowing, it was like, okay, now I need to retrain my eyes. I don't know where I got the drive from, because some days I'd feel helpless, but most of the time I used to say, I'm doing this, I'm getting home, I'm getting out of here, I don't belong here. And the mind frame, I just kept saying those words over and over then. I used to think of Rocky a lot.
What was the stage then? So swallowing, and then moving your eyes, getting your stereoscopic vision back, and then it's moving your head. And what stages go from there?
Well, once I saw a little flicker in my thumb, I'd been trying at night time in my head, closing my eyes, and trying to squeeze my fingers together. Even though they weren't touching, they weren't squeezing, well, in my head I was just imagining. I was trying to push them. I was trying just to get the skin to touch each other. Just imagining touching the skin very lightly. And they probably weren't, but in my head, I think they were. They felt like they were. I was doing like, close your fingers, open. Close your fingers, open. And they weren't doing that, but in my head, they were. And then one day, I woke up. And I remember looking down and seeing my thumb twitch. And I thought, is that me? I tried again, switched again. I thought, oh my God. It was, you could barely see it to really concentrate. It was less than half a mil. It was nothing. But it was something to me. It was everything. So I called in Cora that night and I spelled out the word thumb. And she looked at my thumb and she agreed she could see it. And the fact that she could see it and knew I wasn't hallucinating, it was real. My thumb was moving. Albeit like half a mil, but it's moving. And that was everything to me. My sister and brother, my brother-in-law, Brad, came in, and I was brought up to be well-mannered, but I could not even look at them. I was so intense with looking at my thumb, and I thought, I've got to get improve that movement, and it was just became an obsession. From that moment on, this obsession started.
So you go from a twitch to where?
Well, once Dr. Blacker, who's my neurologist, had seen the movement of the thumb and was assessing me for rehab, and I was spinning my head everywhere as fast as I could to try and make a good impression. I mean, how can you show off by shaking your head? But I was. I was just desperate to be given a chance for rehab. And yes, they got me to rehab at Shenton Park.
So bit by bit, you learn to move your thumb, your fingers, your hands, your arms, and then to stand up, and then to walk. What was it like to leave hospital?
Well, leaving Charlie's, I was very scared because, you know, they say institutionalised. Well, I was. The nurses all had been that close to me. Like, girls would say things like, oh, don't worry, we like poo, it's okay. And they make you feel really good. And they get to know you. And they are your mother. They're all your mother or your close family because they do everything for you. So when I left them, I was scared. I was scared of leaving my security family behind.
So all that physiotherapy you did, learning to move and doing years of speech therapy and physiotherapy, you're now in a state where you can walk and you're talking with me and you can pick things up. And as you say, your right side isn't that great. But are you still in that mindset of working at things all the time, working? Are you still in that mindset of the guy who was lying in bed trying to retrain his eyes so he could focus on a point on the ceiling?
I've just reached a point in my recovery now where I'm letting myself enjoy life again. Because for a long time, when I was with Jade and stuff, my life was always about full-on 100% recovery, like what I eat and the thing that I do. I couldn't take my mind off it still for many years. But recently, I've now tried to put things in order, like I'm going to gym once a week, but I go trampolining once a week, maybe once a fortnight. I'm going to TAFE for my new course at the moment, so I'm pushing my brain in different ways now, trying to learn, trying to restudy. I can't believe this, but I'm learning guitar and I'm loving it. Because before the stroke, I thought, oh, I can't play, can't do it. And after this, I've realised it's not about what you can't do. It's about if you apply yourself, you can do it. So I've taught myself. I'm only playing 3 to 5 chords, but it's coming. I'm really liking it.
You said you're studying at TAFE. What do you want to do with your life now?
Well, before it was a lot of money. Now it's not about money. Because I've realised money means nothing. I used to think have the big four-wheel drive and want a Bose and want a house and all those sort of things. Now I just want to have a car that starts, be able to go into my cupboards and eat some food that's there and have loads of friends and someone to love. I've decided to try to be assistant therapist with the Allied Healthcare. So I believe there's many areas you can go into, but they're all assisting in physio or OT or speech. Or there's many different areas I can go into, but I'd like to assist.
Do you think you might have a powerful story for other stroke victims to tell if you're there as an assistant physiotherapist?
Well, I've been told I'll have to be careful of that because I want to help people, but everyone's different and everyone's recovery is different and everyone's stroke's different. So I just want to help. And the main thing, my book is, my story is the one thing that is helping people, so that's good enough.
How did your marriage stand up to all these changes that were coming your way?
It's very challenging, and stroke has a lot of things that changes you as a person. I won't say that every marriage is going to fail because of stroke, because you've got to work at some things. I found the hardest part in our breakdown was I wanted to sleep in a separate bedroom because I was working so hard at rehab and I found it easy to sleep alone. I had anger problems, frustration problems, and say you're really angry about something really minor, but it's because you're built up with the frustration already, so something small can top you off. So yeah, those issues, and social issues were problems too. Like, I didn't want to drink, I didn't want to be around people smoking. I valued my life so much that I didn't want to, when I looked around and I saw where I was sitting, my mind's changed a bit now, I don't mind having a beer once in a while, but I saw everyone out there trying to kill themselves because I was there, I had a trachea and I couldn't breathe, and I know it's like a coffee ball of stuff through your neck, I know how valuable your lungs are. And it changes you as a person, it changes you. And I didn't want to be that person anymore.
What sort of things would make it easier for stroke victims to recover, to your mind?
I think the one thing we're really lacking is the rehab. The facilities, after you've come out of hospital, you are given outpatients, maybe a year or two. For a lot of people, there isn't the facilities there that are safe enough to go to. I actually skipped it and managed to make it to the gym, but I fell over a few times and badly hurt myself. That's because there's no rehab that I could actually get to local in my area. I was forced to take unnecessary risks. It takes many, many, many years to recover. A vast majority of people that have had a stroke, they don't want to sit at home and claim. They want to get out there and mend themselves. But there's no facilities.
Do you think you're a more morally serious person now than you were before the stroke?
I think my eyes are open. Before this, it was about getting home for a scotch and a smoke at the bar, and yeah, you think yourself more. But now, I don't really think of myself. You've got to split life up into like thirds, you know, one third yourself, and that means your healthy fitness and you and your life, and then one third you've got to try and give back as well, and then the other third you have to make sure you're running your bills and do the things, all the serious stuff. But between those three, you reckon the secrets of life is a balance, and that is true, a balance, yeah.
Great to speak with you, Pete, and hear your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.